Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to 3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
这个节目是由墨尔本 Fitzroy 的 3CR 电台空中同志节目制作的。我们坚持尊重这片土地原住民的立场，尊重库伦国家的 Wurundjeri、Boonwurrung、Wadawurrung、Taungurrung 和 Jajawurrung 古老的文化传统，并希望这种文化源远流长。
We recognize the impact of colonization on gender and sexuality, and we honor the leadership of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders in supporting lesbian, gay, bisexual, sister girl, brother boy, queer and gender diverse people in and beyond their communities, not only in the face of transphobia, biphobia and homophobia, but also racism and cultural suppression. Welcome to We Weren't Born Yesterday, a project by the Queering the Air Collective at 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. I'm your host, Leah Incognita, and today I'll be presenting the Chinese episode of this four-part series exploring queer heritage, vocabulary, and intergenerational connections in migrant communities in Australia. It's been so thrilling, joyful, and fulfilling to be part of this project because it's really close to my heart. Lesbian, bisexual, gay, trans, genderqueer and intersex people from migrant backgrounds are doubly marginalised and underrepresented. You see stories about nice ethnic families that might have a few extra aunties and uncles, but otherwise are just like all the other Aussie battlers. And then in gay hookup apps like Grindr, you see profiles saying no rice, no curry. Both multicultural media and GLBTI media can be so eager to show that queers and ethnics are nearly normal. So we are queer ethnics make it all too complicated for everyone. Growing up in Australia, everything I saw of queerness as a kid was white. I imagine being part of GLBTI community meant trading Chinese culture for queer culture. It's taken a concerted effort to find other queer and trans people of colour, to build up spaces where culture is visible and present, and where we can talk about the ways that racism, transphobia, homophobia and sexism intersect in our lives. One thing that queer people of colour hear a lot is this myth that queerness is new to our cultures, that it's a modern trend or it comes from Western influence. And I know that's not true because I look at Chinese literature and their homoerotic references going back to long before the English language even came into existence. One literary euphemism for relationships between men is 断袖, the cut sleeve. It refers to the story that a Han Dynasty emperor woke to find his lover lying across his robe, so he tenderly cut the sleeve off rather than wake his sleeping beloved. There are other stories going back to hundreds of years BCE. So on this show, we're going to hear from different generations of Chinese Australian queers. We'll look at the wealth of queer culture produced by ethnic Chinese around the world, and we'll even talk a little in Chinese about being queer, because I'm really keen to show everyone that we weren't born yesterday. You're listening to Queering the Air on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. And today on We Weren't Born Yesterday, I'll begin by speaking to William Young, one of Australia's greatest storytellers. Family and filiality is essential to Chinese culture. But of course, family relationships can also be fraught for many GLBTI people. Transphobia and homophobia are only some of the many reasons why queer people of diasporic backgrounds might be cut off from their elders. For me as a first-generation Chinese migrant to this country, I need to have a sense of my own lineage, or I feel kind of untethered, living on stolen land and so far from my ancestors. On the rare occasions that queer Chinese people are represented, we're so often shown to be young, always new, always emergent, which doesn't help you feel that your life is solid, that you can ever become established or belong somewhere, or that you have a future. So I felt very privileged to interview William Young. William was born in North Queensland in 1943, and his family migrated from China in the 1880s. So to me, he is an elder not only as a person in his 70s, but also as someone whose ancestors represent the first generation of Chinese Australians. And he has documented Chinese Australian history and the growth of the gay community in such a moving way.
A prolific photographer and a performer of monologues with slide projections, William Young's stories describe the experience of coming to terms with his identity as a gay Chinese Australian. His first solo exhibition, Sydney Files, was held in 1977 at the Australian Centre for Photography and has since been followed by solo and group exhibitions across Asia, Australia, Europe and North America, and has won numerous awards and accolades. I spoke to him in December 2014. William, you were born in northern Queensland in 1943. What was it like growing up gay and Chinese in the 40s and 50s?
The first time I realised I was different, I was about 6 years old, and one of the kids at school called me Ching Chong Chinaman, and it was a kind of defining moment for me because I suddenly realised that I was Chinese and different. And I got very little support from my family. Growing up gay, I guess from a very early age, I'd always known that I was gay, but I didn't really quite know what that meant. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I read an article in the afternoon newspaper about homosexuality. And then I realized that I was a homosexual, and that there was a name for my condition, although I didn't know any other gay people, and so I was rather isolated in growing up in North Queensland. Although the fact that I was Chinese meant a lot to me, or I got a lot of flack from that at high school, but I wouldn't say I was crippled by racial discrimination. And in fact, the country town where I lived in Dimbula was quite multicultural, as there are a lot of Italian and Croatian migrants there growing tobacco. So it was a kind of mixed experience that I had growing up.
Both your mother and father's families had been living in Australia for over 60 years when you were born. Were you connected to Chinese culture or community through your childhood?
There was a certain connection with my relatives because I had relatives in Cairns, none in Dimbula in the town that I grew up in, and they were connected to a network or Chinese community. And there was a Chinatown in Cairns, and we'd often go down to Cairns from Dimbula to buy groceries at least twice a year and visit my Aunt Bessie, who was the matriarch of the family. And we ate Chinese food, but there wasn't really, even by that first generation, my parents, who were born in Australia, we didn't have any Chinese customs. In fact, my mother made a point of not bringing us up in the Chinese tradition because she thought it was rather superstitious. But my mother had had bad experiences with being Chinese. My uncle had been murdered, and the person who murdered him was acquitted of first-degree murder, and the Chinese at the time felt that that was a great miscarriage of justice. So my mother had that experience, and she was determined to bring us up as anonymously as possible, and she wanted us to be more Australian than the Australians.
When you went to Sydney, you became both a participant and a photographer of the gay community that was developing there. Tell us about moving to Sydney in 1969.
I came to Sydney in 1969, the same year as Stonewall, about which I'd never heard. And I'd been in the closet in Brisbane, and coming to Sydney meant that I could reinvent myself and I could come out as a gay person. And there were the early years of gay liberation, and I was swept along with that movement, and it was quite easy for me to come out as a gay man. In fact, I don't remember consciously coming out because I was surrounded by people who were coming out as gay. I'd also met the older generation because there was a gay community in Sydney pre-Stonewall, and I knew people from that group, and I also knew the new, well, there were many student radicals, and I quickly identified with them, and I just came out as a gay person without thinking too much about it.
Some of your photographs document Asian Australian LGBT groups and events. When did this community begin to come together?
Well, you see, I'm talking about the 70s, let's say 1975. Asians never really came to the party. This is the gay community until the 90s, so that's over 20 years after Stonewall, it took Asians to actually form some kind of Asian gay identity. And I was, initiated a group called Asian Lesbian and Gay Pride, and this was in about 1992 or 93. There were other groups in Sydney at that time. The lesbians had a group, Sydney Asian Lesbians, and there was a group called Silk Road, which was affiliated with ACON, the AIDS Council of New South Wales. And they used to have meetings as part of an ACON program. So, and there was also a group called Long Young, and yes, I think that they were the three main groups. But when I initiated Asian Lesbian and Gay Pride, it brought the gay Asian men and the lesbians together. And it had more of a political agenda because the other groups had social agendas. And we had a seminar as our very first event where we talked about what it's like to be Asian within a predominantly Anglo-gay community. And we talked about racism. We talked about the politics of desire, how there was a perception that Asians weren't considered sexual, or all our models for desire were actually white models. And there was also the fact that most Asians preferred white people as partners. So we talked about all those things, and later we had floats in the Mardi Gras. And later still, we used to have big Chinese New Year parties. This is in the late 90s, as part of the Mardi Gras festival, and they were a huge success. We had about five of them in the Chinese gardens, and they were perhaps our most successful manifestation, because by then we were able to get our message across. Which is, here we are, we're gay and lesbian Asians within the community. We've got our own identity, and the parties were generally fun events, and they were very well attended in that very beautiful setting of the Chinese gardens in Darling Harbour.
Fantastic. love that your photography and performance provide both a historical record of marginalized communities and growing social movements, and at the same time, they're so deeply intimate. For me, as an Asian queer woman and a feminist, your work really speaks to me in how it hones in on really the most tender intersection between the personal and the political. What is your approach to this material?
I guess I started off being a documentary photographer. So it meant that I just photographed the world around me. I didn't interfere too much with the images, and I didn't invent them. Then I started to do performance pieces, which is talking with images in the theatre. And so I guess I added a narrative to my images, and that worked very well for me because my performance pieces have been my most successful form. And I guess when I had exhibitions, I wanted to bring that narrative to the image, and I did that by writing on the image. And I've done that ever since the 90s, ever since I've done performance pieces. And it's become like my favorite form of showing pictures with writing, because my own handwriting also identifies the image as one of mine. So it's worked that way to the extent that now most of the work that I do has got writing on it. There's usually some concept or narrative to the picture. And so I've really claimed that form as my own. And it means that I can do works that have got a kind of, it's quite easy to put a political slant on an image with writing.
What do you think has changed culturally in the mainstream and also in the margins for LGBT and Chinese Australians over the years?
Well, I think it's the same story as with the mainstream gay movement. You have to, first of all, come out, and there's always quite a lot of opposition when you do come out. And gradually, just by being visible, you win over the population. You've got a social profile, and people take a while to change attitude and a social attitude. It's taken many years. If you look at the history of the Mardi Gras or the gay movement in Australia, it's taken 40 years to get where we are now. But there has been social change, quite big social change, especially in the cities. There are places in the regions which are a bit behind the times, and it can be difficult. And the same can be said with the Asian community, although it's taken longer. As I said before, it took 20 years for Asian gays and lesbians to actually become visible. That was 20 years after or even 30 years after the mainstream gay movement. So it's taken longer, but slowly and surely people are having a consciousness of gay Asians. And this is in the West, let's call Australia the West, where this is happening. But there's Asia, the continent, where it's much harder to have social change. But that is happening too. And I've seen it in films. There are more gay characters in Asian films, because I've just been to the Brisbane Asia Pacific Film Festival in Brisbane, and I noticed that there were gay characters in those Asian films, which was very interesting.
And finally, as I suppose an elder in our Chinese Australian LGBT community, is there any advice you'd like to give young LGBT Chinese Australians?
I just think that you just play it by ear. I wouldn't have any other advice apart from be yourself and be visible.
That was photographer and storyteller William Young speaking to me about his life and work.
Bạn đang nghe tới.
Áp sùn rồi hè.
Nǐ zài tīng.
Al an tasmǎunà ilā.
You're listening to
We Weren't Born Yesterday.
Exploring Queer Heritage.
A project by the Queering the Air Collective
at 3CR Community Radio.
You're listening to Queering the Air on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. And in this segment on We Weren't Born Yesterday, we're talking about Chinese language queer cinema. Olivia Koo from Monash Uni and Fran Martin from Melbourne Uni are two Melbourne-based academics whose research deals with Asian media, cinema and queerness. Fran Martin is an associate professor in cultural studies at Melbourne University, whose book publications include Backward Glances, Contemporary Chinese Cultures and the Female Homoerotic Imaginary in 2010, and Situating Sexualities, Queer Representation in Taiwanese Fiction, Film and Public Culture, 2003. Olivia Koo is a senior lecturer in film and screen studies at Monash University, whose research interests include Asian and Australian film and popular culture and gender and sexuality in the Asia Pacific. She's the author of The Chinese Exotic, Modern Diasporic Femininity, 2007, and the co-editor with Audrey Yue of Sinophone Cinemas, 2014. Olivia is also an executive member of the Asian Australian Studies Research Network. I asked Olivia and Fran to talk about the history of queerness in Chinese language film.
I guess it depends on what you mean by queerness, and there are lots of early representations of homosexuality in Chinese language cinema, but they don't always represent what we might kind of consider to be queerness today. And a lot of them were made, for example, images of women kissing, they would be made for the pleasure of male audiences. So I think it might be slightly different depending on what your definition of queerness is.
I mean, I kind of see it as there's a whole history of Chinese cinemas, I'd say, from different parts of like the Chinese speaking or the ethnically Chinese world, and I'd probably, you can kind of divide it into queer cinema, which is self-consciously queer, maybe made by self-identified lesbian, gay, queer, trans, whatever filmmakers, which probably began kind of approximately around, the end of the 20th century, around the 1990s-ish, but before that there's this whole history of, representations that you could call queer, they're like genderqueer, or they have same-sex sexuality elements. And I guess, one really early one that it's like a cross-dressing film, which is an interesting. So it's called Hua Shen Gu Niang, or Miss Change Body, also known as Tomboy. But it involves a female character dressing up as a male character and sort of ending up in a comic romantic situation with another female character. So that's from 1936 in China. But whether you see that as queer cinema or whether you see that as something else, I don't know. I think it's kind of it's an interesting film, and it's interesting to look at those representations from a contemporary standpoint, and then we can read them as queer, which certainly probably, film-loving audiences in China and elsewhere would sort of like to go back and do that work of excavating the queerness of the past.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you consider kind of queerness as a way of reading these films, then, it definitely helps kind of queer audiences today sort of look back and see that there's a longer history maybe to these representations.
My own sort of area that I know probably most about in terms of Chinese queer cinemas is Taiwan. So, and that's, it's an interesting place, even though it's, a peripheral island in a sense. It's been rather central to the growth of a LGBTQ culture and activist politics since the 1990s. So we can sort of look back and see the way that queer-themed film began to emerge in the early 1990s or thereabouts in Taiwan, alongside the growth of what's called the Tongzhi, or queer movement there. So, in fact, the term Tongzhi itself, which is a really often used term to sort of, it's sort of like a, it's a little bit like LGBTQ for Mandarin-speaking audiences, I guess, or Chinese-reading audiences. It actually first appeared as the title of a queer film festival by the Hong Kong film worker Edward Lam. He translated new queer cinema as Xin Tongzhi Dianying, and then the word Tongzhi came to mean queer in Chinese-speaking communities worldwide, which is interesting. So that was in 1992 that the term sort of first emerged in that sense. And that was also around the time that Malaysian-Taiwanese director Tsai Ming-liang started to produce. He kind of makes these art house films that are very slow and artistic and difficult, but a lot of them also have a lot of kind of queer content.
If we're talking about kind of important films and directors, there are a lot of very seminal, I guess, mainstream directors. Do you have
them? Yeah. 1996
for
so Yang still... plus or minus Yin, Gender, yep, in Chinese Cinema, which is like a documentary
that's
about
right.
himself,
yes,
in a way.
Yes, that's yeah. really his kind of coming out yeah. Piece. But there were other films. I think for me, Farewell, My Concubine was like a significant film. So it's really kind of having these, very sort of well-known, major mainstream directors like Chiang Kai-ge. Make films like Farewell, My Concubine, which really allowed people to imagine, I guess, same-sex relationships on screen to a much wider audience. And I think, I'm not sure, that possibly developed in parallel to what you're describing as a more kind of identity politics-based filmmaking.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that's 1993. I think an example of that, like Farewell, My Concubine, is a really interesting one because it's almost straddling that division that we constructed before between sort of films that have queer elements but maybe aren't directed at queerness in a self-conscious way or queer audiences in a self-conscious way. And on the other hand, sort of gay and lesbian identity politics, which came a bit later. So that one kind of does both. Like, it's kind of a historical cultural story, but it's been very popular with gay and lesbian audiences, and it's seen as a queer film. So it's an interesting sort of hybrid. The other one that I think is really, I always loved this film, I think it's really interesting, from around the same time, also mainland China, is East Palace, West Palace by Zhang Yuan, 1996. It's the most amazing film where there's a gay man cruising in a certain cruisy area near Tiananmen Square in Beijing, and he gets picked up by the police and taken back for interrogation to the police station. And really it sort of develops, and the film is kind of the story of the interrogation throughout the rest of that night, and it sort of develops into like a lightly sort of SM homoerotic relationship between the two of them. So where the gay man is not, in a way, he doesn't mind having this interrogation. He gets this very intense, there's a very intense relationship emerges between the two of them without actual sex. But it's sort of an interesting psychology. And at the time it seemed like an absolutely amazing commentary on the authoritarian state, like that the representative of the state is cast in the role of sort of SM top to this gay cruising man in Tiananmen Square. I mean, it's just kind of quite explosive.
For me, that was kind of a turning point as well in terms of mainland Chinese cinema and queerness. There are a lot of documentaries made by women. I think women were making sort of films that became known probably a bit later than the male directors. So early 2000s, would you say?
Yeah.
There's Yao Qing's Ho Yuk, Let's Love Hong Kong, which was 2001.
I will tell you, that sounds right.
Which wasn't a documentary, but a lot of this, the kind of aesthetics of a lot of the films made, because they're made with low budget, they are well, they tend to be sort of more experimental, perhaps, and grittier, I think, a lot of the ones. So Liu's Fish and Elephant as well.
Yeah.
She had she just employed a non-professional couple to play the...
An activist, in fact, Chateau, the actress there. Mm. Yeah, and her girlfriend of the time, I think, if I'm not wrong, might have been playing both the lead roles there.
Right.
I mean, to me, yeah, Niao Qing's film is another example of a very sort of experimental one, which when I interviewed her about that a number of years ago now, she said, I said, you know, what was your motivations for making this film, Let's Love Hong Kong? And she said she wanted to have, it's an interesting answer, she wanted to have the kind of film that she could use for teaching her students about queer cinema. So it's like, right. It's a theory film in a way, which she made. I mean, I'm sure she made it for other reasons than that, but that was one of the reasons that she cited. Mm. So, yeah, it's sort of, it's a fairly intellectual kind of take on queer life in Hong Kong. Queer teen picks are a bit of a thing, getting into a more popular commercial genre.
Yeah, and Fran's written about this in her book, Backward Glances. And one of my favourite films that Fran has written about, which is very beautiful, is Blue Gate Crossing.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking about in the category of teen pick.
Let's talk about that one.
So that's directed by Taiwanese director Yi Zhiyan, and it came out, it's actually a Taiwanese-French co-production. It's part of a bit of a trend in many national cinemas these days is to be transnational in there and be co-productions across more than one nation. It came out in 2002. Yeah, so it's part of a maybe, you know, the connection that you're mentioning it there in Olivia is in relation to a trend that I identified in that book you mentioned where across a range of sort of mass cultural or fairly popular representations of same-sex love between women in modern Chinese cultures across mainland Hong Kong and Taiwanese cultural production, there's this real trend of having same-sex female relationships happening in youth or at school and then being terminated in the narrative, usually by a disapproving parent, like often a mother, or the school authorities, or simply social pressure, kind of pushing one or both of the young women to get married or to get into a heterosexual relationship. So then these kind of youthful same-sex loves are recalled from the point of, like, in a memorial mode, what I call a memorial mode, that so the adult woman has grown up, has been basically corralled into straight relationships and is remembering this kind of lost utopia of her youth. So there's a whole lot of examples I could quote, not just from film, but from television, from popular fiction and other sources that have that kind of narrative. But this particular one, Blue Gate Crossing, I think is interesting because in a way, because it's a teen pick and it's sort of it's set in a school and it's kind of about a love triangle between two girls and one boy. It's got a sort of nostalgic feel, hasn't it? Like the whole thing has this kind of glow to it, as if it's being remembered, but it's actually not narrated in the past very strongly. There may be some voiceovers that are sort of a bit memory-ish, but in the end, you don't know what's going to happen. So it's not certain. It's very possible that the protagonist, who seems to be, you know, she's fallen in love with her female schoolmate, it seems as though she may go on. She could go either way. You know, we don't know that she's going to, she may not be straightened out at the end. So it's a bit of a break with the pattern that I identified.
Yeah, and extremely important for queer audiences to know that there is something possibly hopeful in that relationship rather than it being either a phase or something that, you know, you grow out of and then you get married and kind of it's something you look back on nostalgically. So
yeah,
I think Butterfly, the Hong Kong film,
yes,
is sort of similar in that sense, being narrated by an adult woman who's in a very unhappy marriage that she wants to leave, remembering like a very passionate affair that she had with another young girl when she was in her teens, I guess. So yeah, kind of following that sort of similar trend, but at the same time, I think it was hopeful.
That,
that something might, you know, you could actually be kind of a fully embodied person who also loved someone of the same sex,
and with a future with that person, because she leaves her husband. I mean, it's kind of revolutionary. Yes. She leaves her husband and young son, and goes with this woman that she's met, not the one that she had the relationship when she was at school, but that it's kind of like those two same sex relationships are sort of paralleled in the narrative of the film. To have someone, to kiss someone. And the interesting thing about that one too, another thing is that it's an example of another trend in contemporary, well, Chinese filmmaking generally, and including queer cinema, of sort of productions that draw on talents and scripts and resources from different areas of the Sinophone or the Chinese-speaking world. So the novella that's based on is by a Taiwanese writer, Chen Xue, called Mark of the Butterfly, and then it's made by a Hong Kong director, and some of the actresses in it are from mainland China. Tian Yuan's from Wuhan, I think. So it's kind of all mixed together, which is really quite interesting.
蝴蝶是你的名字，你知道吗？不能飞就不是蝴蝶了。In terms of other connections with diasporic audiences and how we receive those films, there have been some really significant directors in the Australian context, and I'm thinking particularly of Tony Ayres, who's been probably one of the most successful directors that we Asian Australian directors that we have, but also Australian directors anyway. And there's two films that he's made that have, I think, been really significant in the context of queer representations in Australia, and they are China Dolls, which was really a kind of documentary about Tony Ayres growing up, feeling he was kind of different growing up gay in Australia. And the other film is Sadness, sort of a documentary about William Yang, but it's William Yang kind of narrating. It's a slideshow that he did about his family and going back to a far north Queensland to trace his connections there. So if we think about kind of diasporic filmmakers like Tony Ayres, I think they're really important for Asian Australians, not necessarily sort of Chinese-speaking diasporic audiences, to kind of feel like they... I don't know, that they can see people that represent them on the screen in this context.
Absolutely. And I think that links to a broader point about the cultural importance and impact of queer cinema. Anywhere. I mean, I agree, particularly in diasporic contexts, perhaps where there's both sort of sexual minoritisation and racial minoritisation going on. Obviously, it's very important for, you know, social minorities to see themselves represented and to identify, you know, with those representations, but also for queer audiences in other parts of the world. I mean, it's the case in Taiwan and Hong Kong that, you know, that queer film festivals have emerged since the 1990s and have been really important community-making events, just as they are wherever they happen. A particularly interesting case of that, though, is in mainland China, where it's much harder to have a queer film festival. You can have them if they're very small, if they're very underground. They have been known to go ahead. More recently, though, I think just this year, the Beijing Queer Film Festival, which was planned, was disrupted again by authorities. They sort of seem to do it every second year or something. But this time I understand they actually confiscated a lot of materials and it was much more heavy-handed than before. So, you know, you can sort of see that directors, audiences and people organising are really up against a big challenge there. And actually, it seems that film culture has a big part to play in enabling the creation of a community there under sometimes really difficult circumstances as well.
That was Fran Martin and Olivia Koo talking about queerness in Chinese language cinema around the world. You're listening to We Weren't Born Yesterday, a project by the Queering the Air Collective on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. And in this segment, we're going to hear a few different queer Chinese people tell their stories. Fran Lee, Karen Yi,
Stephanie Lai and myself talk about our experiences of queer community in Taiwan, mainland China, and Australia, and our thoughts on queer Chinese culture. Although my own first language is Shanghainese, and I would have liked to include stories in each of the many distinct Chinese languages that are spoken, for the sake of mutual understanding, this segment is in Mandarin Chinese and English. Even in Mandarin, though, there are interesting variations in the vocabulary used by GLBTIQ communities across mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and the diaspora in Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, and other countries.
大家好，我是名字是Frank，我是来自台湾，现在在这个澳洲墨尔本大学念博士班。那蛮荣幸可以被邀请上来这个节目来讲一下关于自己以及关于自己跟中国文化的一些连结。那大部分的人可能想到中国Chinese的话，可能都是想到 Mainland China。 我的case比较不一样一点，就是我是台湾，那大家当然也蛮认识台湾的。 这个台湾这样的地方呢，其实它刚好跟 Mainland China 比较有个蛮大的不同之处，就是我们的 LGBT 的活动跟自由度似乎是在所有的 Chinese community 里面算是比较前进一点的，甚至于我们有亚洲最大的同志游行。那这一年来，台湾的同志团体也一直在努力，要让通过就是婚姻平权，就是同性婚姻，甚至于有其他的多元成家法案，就是不只是限于同性婚姻，也有伴侣制。 那甚至于是一个家庭不只限于两个伴侣这样子的法案，那我还蛮荣幸，就是也蛮高兴台湾可以是一个相对在亚洲里面，不过那也只是亚洲啦，还是蛮可惜的，比较开放的一个地方。所以如果台湾能够顺利的尽快争取到同志婚姻或者是多元成家法案的话，我会觉得那是一个很好的指标，尤其这就是 中国文化，华人文化，应该这样讲，我比较习惯用华人文化这样子的字眼来形容。华人文化里面一个重要指标，那大家就觉得有更宽广的一个视野。那我大概是从什么时候开始认知到我自己是喜欢同性的呢？其实严格说起来，我天生算是双性恋吧，因为我小时候真的也很明显的，也很深深的有爱过男生的经验，大概在 其实蛮有趣的，我国小、国中就会看那种漫画，就是两个男生的那种少女漫画，看得很喜欢，非常喜欢，喜欢到我觉得我好想当gay哦，就觉得说哇，如果我可以像漫画里面那两个男生那种多好。我记得蛮清楚，在我初中的时候，我曾经问过我自己，啊，我好想当哦，那可是我不是男的啊，那如果我是女的，那我要当女同性恋吗？但是我记得当时我对我自己的回答是，哎呀，可是我不是。 那可见那个时候是没有这个意识的。直到我上了高中，我念了台湾台北就是前面明星学校的一个女中，进到里面去高一的时候，对女生就很有感觉了，但不晓得那个叫爱情。到了高二的时候，我们那个叫高中哦，所以高一高二，高二的时候看到新进来的学妹竟然已经双双对对走在一起，那所以我才知道啊，原来是 两个女生是可以这样子的。到了高三的时候，我就也找了一个学妹跟我在一起。我完全没有挣扎或是犹豫过我怎么会喜欢同性。对我而言，从小到大没有任何一刻让我质疑过或是拒绝过或是排斥过这样子的一个感觉跟身份。甚至于我非常的拥抱，我觉得这感觉第一个我觉得很自然，第二个我觉得很快乐。那慢慢的你去认识到从社团里面看到别人的不开心， 或者看到这个社会对于同性同志之间的这种污名化，我反而是更觉得我应该要有力气去为这个社团付出。所以我一直在当义工，我知道有很多人他在面对这样子自己的一个信任同的时候，他是很痛苦的，那可能来自于很多各种原因。那不要说是幸运，我觉得就是每一个人的路径都不一样，我比较没有这方面的问题，那相对的我就比较像是一个 我觉得有点像是太阳的感觉，就是我要把我的温暖跟这份骄傲跟这个自然与快乐带给我的朋友跟我周遭的就是其他能够遇到的人。我没有完全的100%的跟长辈们出柜，因为我觉得目前还没有这个必要。但是我在同志圈里面，台湾的同志圈里面，我当过不同机构的义工。我现在主要是针对就是其实蛮多方面的耶，像是女同志方面啦，或者是同志他自己生小孩的方面的这些义工我都做过。我觉得在台湾的同志圈，我们的生态是很多样的，有的人可能致力于 HIV AIDS 的防治，也有人是致力于父母沟通跟同志孩子之间的沟通，那也有人是着重于不同的议题，其实蛮多元的。要这样子讲，我还真的还不晓得突然间要怎么样去叙述形容这些。那其实我真的蛮高兴能够在这个同志圈里面为中国华人文化付出一份心力。
梦还没有完，泪流上各甜，别离亦不怕，若谁在意。
大家好，我的名字叫易可人，今年25岁，我来自中国大陆中南部的湖南省。我在18岁以前一直生长在国内，然后呢，一直生活在一个大学老师的家庭。我的父母，都是大学教师，因此我觉得，他们也给了我一个相对自由的环境。其实，在初中的时候，我就对自己的性取向有过一定的怀疑。但是那个时候的话，因为自己年龄也比较小，而且很少可以接触到相关的信息，所以自己也没有太多概念。直到在1999年到2000年左右，当互联网开始逐渐流行起来，然后呢，我自己也会在网上进行一些搜索，然后开始初步对包括在同性恋相关的性少数有一定的了解，然后在随后我。进入高中以后，其实是进入了一家私立的寄宿学校，所以说我长期会见不到自己的父母，而是经常会跟其他的男同学待在寝室里面。然后呢，尤其是在晚上睡觉之前，我们经常就会一些聊天呢、因为男孩子之间嘛，经常就会聊到一些跟性有关的话题。然后有些男生甚至会提到，就是说他们有过的其实算是同性的性经历。然后呢，即使是这样子，然后我还是非常就是说觉得非常不解的感觉。2008年的时候，我来到了澳大利亚，然后呢，首先是去了阿德莱德大学学习本科。我本科学习的内容是媒体和媒体制作。其实刚来澳洲的时候，因为一个新的环境，所以我对澳洲并不是特别熟悉，所以说呢，有一段时间对自己的性取向什么都没有太多的想法。直到2009年夏天的时候，我接触了一门新的课程，是关于在媒体中的性别表达和性的表达。然后呢，随后的一年，我又在美国交换的过程中接触到了跟性政治和性别政治的相关的课题，直到。这个时候我开始逐渐对自己性少数的身份有了一定的所谓的确认。从美国回来以后呢，很快我就开始攻读自己的 Honors 学位，然后我自己也给自己选择了跟性表达相关，媒体中性表达相关的课题。然后呢，在2012年我来到墨尔本开始读我的博士学位。我现在个人的学习的和研究的内容呢，是关于华语圈的性少数的自我表达，尤其是在社交媒体中，其实包括像 Grindr 啊、Jack 之类的手机软件，都能自我表达。我其实会，我的研究呢，其实是包括两个部分的，一个部分呢是关于在中国大陆的同志和在他们的自我表达，第二个部分呢是关于。在澳大利亚的新移民和国际学生，他们这些库尔之间的一些自我表达。在过去的2年中，我首先是在中国大陆的5个城市，包括北京、上海、深圳、长沙和呼和浩特，进行了一系列采访。然后呢，在今年早些时候，我又在悉尼和墨尔本进行了几个采访。其实通过这些采访，我发现 无论是在中国大陆还是在澳大利亚，互联网对于这些性少数人群来说，其实是一个非常重要的就是接触其他人的途径。即使在澳大利亚来说，我们通常认为澳大利亚是更开放的社会，但是对于这些新移民，尤其是国际学生来说，这些手机软件或者是社交媒体，通常是他们接触所谓的这个圈子的第一途径。
I'm Stephanie, I'm 32 years old. I grew up in Perth in Western Australia, to a Chinese-Malaysian immigrant mother and an Anglo-Australian father. They met many years ago in Malaysia when my father was in the Air Force there. My mother migrated to Australia after she married him. Because my father was in the Air Force and away a lot,My Asianness was always a really strong part of my identity because I was really concerned with how they'd met, how the colonial elements of that. My entire family is still in Malaysia. So how I've looked at my Asian identity has always been really strong, and my queer identity has never really played into that until relatively recently. In part, that's because I've really lacked the language to talk about it. It's not really something that we've ever addressed in my family. We don't talk about sexuality at all, whether it be in Malay or Chinese, and definitely not in English. Even when I was living in Penang and living in Beijing, amongst people who weren't white, I still kind of lacked the community and language there. So I kind of found myself growing into my queer identity more as...in a white community rather than within an Asian community. And as a result, I've kind of never really come out at home. My entire family knows that I'm queer, but it's something that we literally never talk about. And there's kind of like a hole in the conversation when we talk about my partners or a lot of my friends. I think that was really emphasized for me when I was speaking to my mother of a trans friend, and it was the first time I'd ever spoken about anything trans to my mother, and I had paused to kind of give a really simple explanation, and she sort of snapped at me that she's from Malaysia and she knows exactly what that means to not be trans but to have trans people within your community, and she knew what I was talking about, which kind of was important for me when I realized that...It's not that we lack the language as Chinese Malaysians, it's that we lack the room to discuss it, because we have the language and we have those people in our community. We have people like me in our community, but we don't address that. And as I've become more of a writer, I've looked primarily at identity, and how my queerness and how my Asianness intersects has become really important for me, especially around history. And I've started doing a lot of research, particularly in Southeast Asia, around Malaysian and Southeast Asian histories of queerness, but also around mainland Chinese histories of queerness. And one of the areas I'd really like to explore next is Asian Australian histories of queerness, because I think that we probably do have a really strong history. We certainly are just not aware of it at all.
大家好，我的名字叫晶晶，我今年27岁。我是生在中国大陆上海，4岁的时候来了澳大利亚墨尔本。我小的时候是会说普通话的，但是在澳洲长大，在家里一直说上海话，在外面嘛是说英文，所以我慢慢忘记了普通话。现在我觉得说普通话很困难，我用的词语也是很奇怪的，音也不标准，所以要是你听不懂我说的话，对不起。我13岁这个时候就开始有兴趣这个同性恋的事情，我是因为这个原因14岁离开了天主教的教会，因为我觉得教会的想法和我自己的不同，但是我也没说这跟我自己的兴趣有什么关系， 要是我想说我也不能说，因为我那个时候中文怎么说这种东西我也不知道。我有一次在大学的时候回上海去了一个拉拉吧，我问了一个女同志怎么说这个喜欢女人也喜欢男人的这种人，她说哦，这种人我们叫他们飘，因为他们飘过去飘过来，我们最讨厌这种人，所以我也没有再问她。我用英文可以讨论很多不一样的概念，我可以说这个queer、bisexual、pansexual 这种字，我知道都有不一样的历史、不一样的用法、不一样的意思。但是中文最基本的字我也不知道，我也习惯一直是这样，因为我读书的内容或者工作的事情用中文都是不会说。我英文是一个很喜欢看书文字的人，但是中文我是字也读不来的。我2010年去了马来西亚的 Sexuality Merdeka 节，也去了上海骄傲节，就是 Shanghai Pride。2009年是第一次举办的上海骄傲节。所以我去的是第二次，有2个星期的活动。在那我终于学到这个bisexual 这个字，中文是叫双性恋。我去了几个不一样的活动，但是发现我还是更喜欢这个普通的小的上海的拉拉吧。因为还是觉得用上海话跟人家交流更有趣，所以这几年我也交了点新的朋友，这样我很开心，因为觉得上海变成也是我自己的一个家，本来就是我的父母的老家，还有过去去看长辈，但是没有自己的朋友。我本来觉得好像在上海我一直是一个小孩，回到那边就像我离开的时候又是一个10岁的小孩一样。现在有自己的朋友，也跟那边的同志们有关系，就觉得好像可以有一个更成熟的生活在那里。我家里的人差不多都知道我是同志，但是我也没有特别出柜，也没有特别跟人家说，就是因为我写的文章还有我做这个广播节目，应该现在他们都知道了吧。我做这个节目做了快3年了，这是第一次我们用中文说。但是我做这个节目也不一定很清楚。有一次我妈妈跟我说，你关心这个难民的事情，也支持这个土著人的事，所以你关心这个同志们的事情，我也不知道你意思里说是你也是这种人。我觉得出柜不出柜不是最重要的，但是我想要华人了解，全世界都有我们这种人，永远一直有过我们这种人，我们不是昨天生的。That was Fran, Karen, Steph, and myself telling our stories of finding and building Chinese queer community. You've been listening to We Weren't Born Yesterday, a series exploring queer cultural heritage, vocabulary, and intergenerational connections in migrant communities in Australia. Thank you to all my guests and participants, William Young, Olivia Koo, Fran Martin, Karen Yee, Fran Lee, Stephanie Lai, 2SER in Sydney for helping with recording, Judy Tang and the Australian GLBTIQ Multicultural Council for helping promote this project, and the Community Broadcasting Foundation for funding it. This feature was produced by the Queering the Air Collective at 3CR Community Radio with financial support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Really huge thanks to my marvellous collective and everyone at 3CR. Over and out. Oh.
Thank you for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. 那是一条神奇的